You broke my heart. Broke it in two. Some days I just don't know what I'm supposed to do. And when I see you, trouble ain't far behind. You made me cry a million tears. They'll say that it gets better with the passing of the years. But when I think of you, trouble ain't far behind.
That's one of my favorites, Gary Moore, the late Gary Moore from Northern Ireland, singer and guitarist, phenomenal artist, with Trouble Ain't Far Behind. It's from his 2008 album, Bad For You, Baby. Gary Moore died of a heart attack in his sleep in 2011. He was 58 years old, but left a body of work that still remains testament to his incredible talent and his skill. Real good blues. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Wednesday, June the 24th, a week after the massacre in Charleston, South Carolina. And as we speak, the body of the Reverend Clementa Pinckney, the senior pastor of the church where this gunman attacked and massacred nine, including this pastor, Reverend Pinckney, who also was a state senator. His body lays in state, or lies in state, at the state capital, Columbia. And the Confederate flag still flies just outside of the building where he is in repose. In other news, related news, because the big thing these days now, in the last couple of days, is the sudden realization about the Confederate flag. We have the governor of Alabama, Governor Robert Bentley, deciding today that all Confederate flags will be pulled from state capital, the state capitol grounds. And we have an initiative being mounted also today. At least he expressed that he would start on it today. The lone African American of the congressional delegation from Mississippi, saying that he would try to force a vote in the House on a measure to remove all symbols of Confederacy from the state. Well, we've talked about this. We've talked about the fact that the Confederate flag in and of itself is very symbolic, and I could appreciate the argument because symbols do have great meaning. But I'm continuing the discussion along the lines of not going along with the flow of the discussions. People who understand themselves to be oppressed need to concentrate more on their survival and their agenda and constructing alternative systems to assure both. hundreds of years have passed. The matter of the Confederate flag, for example, that matter supposedly was passed and settled law. It's a really interesting phrase. And we talk about settled law at some time in the future because, of course, we know these laws are not settled. These are just palliatives. These are just things that the system enacts to give the illusion that changes are coming. Well, I'm saying to those people who consider themselves as members of an oppressed group, and it doesn't matter what color you are, this matter, but as it pertains to slavery, because that's really where the United States, that's the philosophy was embedded before slavery actually began. It was embedded in this country as part of the culture and part of the reality, our day-to-day reality. But supposedly since 1865, the badges of slavery should have been eradicated. Since 1865, under the provisions of the 13th Amendment, of course, it hasn't. So while I admire the congressman from South Carolina, from Mississippi, the Democrat Benny Thompson, for making this move to remove the badges of slavery, i.e. the Confederate flag, from the state office buildings and governmental buildings and properties, it is ironic that this fight is coming in 2015 and none other than the House itself, Congress itself, has the power and authority to define and to regulate the so-called badges of slavery by law. So we come back to the same theme I have been talking about for quite a while now. 1865, after the Civil War, this was supposed to be the law of the land. Here we are in 2015 arguing about whether we should be getting so agitated about a Confederate flag. What we ought to do, the thinking I'm saying, is fix it. Fix your thinking. If this was supposed to have been a matter of law since 1865, and all of these administrations, conservative, right-wing, left-wing, centrist, whatever, black presidents, white presidents, it did not have any impact at all with respect to the 13th Amendment, the provisions of the 13th Amendment in Section 2 of the 13th Amendment, saying that not only is slavery abolished, but the badges of slavery also are abolished. And here we are in 2015. It means one of two things. Either the system is so incredibly good at resisting change, or that the changes that should have been sought and obtained or attained simply were not sought and attained. One of the two. But certainly we shouldn't be getting embroiled and getting all emotional about this. It should be for those people who consider themselves oppressed, part of the oppressed community of the United States. It should be for this group a lesson in what it means to be living in an apartheid state. White supremacy, what white supremacy means, and the issue about constructing systems, how systems work since 1865, and we're not counting the previous years. We've been very generous, starting at 1865, when the country said, well, this is the law, and we are committed to it. The same Congress had said, we are committed to it, you know, is a Congress now that one lone congressman from Mississippi in 2015, the lone African-American from Mississippi, is making an effort to compel Congress to do something that it successfully has refused to do since 1865. So the attitude should be, look, we don't need to waste time with that. What we should interpret by this is that we know where we stand, and we are convinced you have shown us, you have proven all this time, and you've gotten the benefit of time, you've gotten the benefit of doubt. We see exactly not only where you are, but what your intention is in perpetuity as it relates to me and people like me. I got that. So the flag and your obsession about the flag and all this talk about the flag, my point of reference was sealed in 1865. I understood the intention. I understood the reality. I am not in any way deluded about thinking that this is something that ought to concern me and that I should use whatever little time I have worrying about your political dilemmas. You demonstrated your resolve in 1865. And between then and now, you have seen to it that you will not observe the law. You will not obey the law, even the law that you yourself constructed. It has no meaning to you. Am I going to spend my lifetime, and am I going to hand this responsibility to the ensuing generations behind me, go and fight them on this law? Heck no. I only need to understand and accept, not in the sense that I agree, but I accept what your intention is. I understand it. And now my job is to see to my survival, to see to my interests, to construct systems that allow me to survive and those coming behind me to survive. You want to fly your flag? Go right ahead. We know what it means to you. We know what you intend it to mean to us. We know all of it's established. Why are we fighting over these things? And here's the thing. Suddenly, in the discourse, whether it's media coverage or you're hearing these discussions going all over the place, it still falls to the people who are the primary targets of white supremacy to fix it, to fix the society. We're not hearing from the broader community, the broader society, the dominant society, either an acknowledgement that it is their problem, it is their mess up, it is their responsibility to fix, because this is how they have structured it. The problem I'm saying that we have is that we don't understand it. We are not accepting it. We're not accepting the reality that has been the reality for hundreds of years. And we keep falling for this ridiculous discussion, these ridiculous arguments, that we're all in this together. You're wrong about that too. We're not all in this together. We're not. This is your sick society. This is what you have constructed. This is the plague you have brought with you and that you scientifically devised to exist in perpetuity. This is what you have wrought. It is not my responsibility to fix it and to fix you. we will hear later on in this program, the typical platitudes coming from the power elite. And it's not that they're morally superior. It is not that they're especially gifted. It is just that they're in power by virtue of their skin color. That's the first requirement. The society is sick. It is psychotic. And it has made this sickness and psychosis the norm that we are all now enveloped in. It affects us all. But that doesn't mean we all have the responsibility to fix it. The people who devised it, that's their responsibility. That is their handiwork. That is their way, their science, their whole system of regulation. This is their society, organized to suit their interests, their needs. It is therefore, when you get this kind of negative fallout, it is their responsibility to fix it. Primarily, it is them. The responsibility of people negatively impacted by it is to see to your survival. Don't waste another minute trying to reach out and touch and embrace and sing unending choruses of "We Shall Overcome." We ought to fix that too. "We shall overcome" should be changed to "We are overcome." We are overcome. Everything is telling us that our systems, we have no systems. We have no response. We have no plan that addresses the basic issue here, which is continued survival. What does our history tell us? Our history tells us that all of our leaders that we respect and revere, and we should, because they were quite visionary, what they did, all about what they did, was about this business of survival, continued survival, laying down structures, devising systems that could work, so that you don't have to buy into this rotten Democratic Party and run every time. It's the Democratic Party that was pro-slavery. The Democratic Party did everything possible to maintain the slaveocracy of the South. You talk about the Confederate flag, you could hand that to the Democrats. But because your historical memory is so stunted, because you have no interest in connecting your present with your past in order that you can even articulate a future, you are more concerned about the survival of a party that has had a history of total annihilation of you and all people who look like you. But hey, you got a black president. And guess what? You have a black president and you have a 21-year-old white supremacist walking into a church, blowing 9 people away, and being able to walk out. Being able to walk out. And people are now dealing with life on his terms. Oh, the Confederate flag. Well, the Confederate flag was an issue when it started, back in 1863. I read you the designer's explanation as to what the flag was designed for, what it was supposed to represent. That hasn't changed. So if in 2015 you choose to act as an intentionally ignorant person, refusing to connect your past with your present, then you are condemned to a dismal future, if you are privileged at all to have one. And that's why I say, don't waste any time with these discussions. They don't concern you. This is not about you. None of this is about you. This is the system simply adjusting itself, considering the circumstances. They're having a bad public relations moment, and they have to do something to kind of take the edge off. Because after all, it's 2015. After all, the whole world is looking at the United States and saying, are these people still stuck with this psychotic behavior of killing each other because of the race? And we dare to talk about the rest of the world and their barbaric practices? And yet this is an ingrained part of the society here in this great nation of ours. They like to talk the collective, you know, ours, as if we all are in this together. It's like the army who says, well, we're all green. Yes, well, the dark green people stand over there, and the light green ones are over there. That's what we have. I'm just pleading for people to come to terms with where we are. Let's not move ahead because, you know, our progressive brothers and sisters, our Latino brothers and sisters, our European brothers and sisters, we're not all in this together. We just are not, because we are all affected by this pernicious thing called white supremacy. We've all been negatively affected by it. But I am saying very clearly, if you consider yourself part of the oppressed community, your job automatically is to basically set aside whatever they are talking about, because you have statistics, you have history on your side to say that hundreds of years, this is the formula. It is unlikely to change in the immediate future. Therefore, I will use my energy and my talents and whatever else I have as assets, I will use those things constructively to assure not only my survival, but the survival of those coming behind me. That is what I've been talking about in terms of progress requires our regress. We have to go back and connect once again with the vision of those who, with their lives, and in this instance, I've raised time and again the example of Denmark Vesey, one of the founders of this church, whose attitude was quite different. Quite different. We have now, as the standard approach in the black clergy, is, you know, sing We Shall Overcome, and that should fix it. And then we go to Washington, and we are happy if the president shakes our hands, and we are happier still if we get an invite to the White House. And for that, we just put all of our people back on the auction block. They all seem to be doing that. Our leadership is compromised and does not have the capacity to lead us in the right direction. It has shown across the board, generally, an absolute unwillingness to confront a system, let alone define and structure an alternative plan. So you, in the face of statistics, in the face of documented history, in the face of what you know, in the face of all of the evidence, if we continue to go down the same path, we deserve exactly what is in store. And it's not good. It's not good. So, do not fret about what society is fretting. Their conversation is not your conversation. Their problems are not yours. Their problem is, how can we effectively contain you? How
do we control you and your progeny forever? How do we maintain dominance forever? That's their conversation. Sometimes it sounds nice and sweet. Sometimes it sounds positively human. Sometimes it sounds like kumbaya. But make no mistake, our history tells us, as an oppressed people, and I'm not saying this just about African Americans, there are people oppressed for all kinds of reasons. And the first obligation, for whatever reason, you as a member of any community define yourself as belonging to an oppressed group, you have a right first to see to your survival. Talk about the Confederate flag, as if we should all be fixated about the Confederate flag. How many people are fixated with the red, black, and green? How many people are fixated with the rainbow flag? The gay community has a flag for a reason. To remind them that theirs is a rainbow struggle. The people struggling for independence in Puerto Rico have a flag. To remind them that they are constantly to be vigilant about the impact and effect of imperialism, U.S. imperialism, and the devastation it has caused their country. Flags are important. And that is why the Confederate flag has been flying, successfully resisting all of these, well, very few, but these attempts such as have been made to take it down, because it represents white supremacy, and white supremacy is very important to a large sector of the United States. See? So the problem is, forget that and their flag. That's their flag. Get to know your own. Get to understand your flag. I always admire when I go to a Haitian event, no matter what it is. You see Haitians flying their flag with great pride because they understand what it means. They get it. They don't care what you think about your Confederate flag or the U.S. flag or anybody else's flag. They understand the importance of their flag. And that's what we need to do, because it's linked to your survival. You have to take back the power of defining your identity, your history, your culture, your very lives. And that's the game that they've all been playing with us. They've been playing this game for a long time. It is time to stop the psychotic behavior of thinking that if you love people hard enough, sacrificially enough, that they will see the error of their ways and they'll do the right thing. If that's your thinking, you have lost your mind. You are a perfect victim. Let's get real. First, let's get real. That is my plea. We'll take this break and come back and discuss again with the backdrop of this massacre in Charleston that for some it is a political windfall. And I'm referring to Hillary Clinton right after this.
I wanna tell you what I am feeling. but the words won't come out right. You left me crying, there's no denying. Turn my sunshine to the darkest night. Someday I'll find somebody new. Then you will know exactly what you put me through. Until that day, trouble ain't far behind. Until that day, behind.
You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM, your favorite, and I hope exclusive, radio station. Well, back in 2008, when this new president, a guy named Barack Obama, was elected, he had as his chief of staff a guy named Rahm Emanuel. And Rahm Emanuel, of course, has gone on in good Chicago politics style to be the mayor of the city of Chicago. But he was a Clintonite holdover. And what did he say? Addressing a group of Wall Street Journal executives, the top corporate executives, because that's the only people that the Clintons talked to, and Obama too. Rahm Emanuel said to them back in 2008, you never want a serious crisis to go to waste. He said, things that we had postponed for too long, that were long-term, are now immediate and must be dealt with. This crisis provides the opportunity for us to do things that we could not do before. And that brings me, of course, to Hillary Clinton, who, in a way, is part of the club, because Rahm Emanuel was a very loyal Clintonite. Well, Sister Hillary sensed that this massacre at Charleston has some kind of value, great value to it. And beginning her 2016 run, presidential run, she needs to make points. And we all know, as does Hillary, a huge part of her electoral success depends on the very people who have been waiting for change for a long time. So she goes down to Missouri. Actually, she goes down. I checked the map. It's exactly 3.4 miles from where Michael Brown was killed last August 9th in Ferguson, Missouri. She goes down to Florissant, Missouri, just yesterday, and she's talking that black talk. A very, very compliant group assembled at Christ the King United Church of Christ in Florissant. And she is now situating herself among the black folks. Later on, people will come behind her. You know, the black preachers will come behind to convince black people she is the perfect one. But I want you to listen to the platitudes and the what should offend any sensible person or anyone connected at all to the history of this country with this speech
And we'll come back and make some comments after it, but I want you to listen very carefully to the tone and how she embraces this whole thing. You will hear her religiosity, and you will hear all the fine points that whoever is writing these scripted speeches for her, all the points that she needs to make, you know, she covers all of that. And then, of course, goes stridently into, vote for me, and I'll set you free. Here's Hillary. Sister Hillary.
How do we make sense of such an evil act? An act of racist terrorism perpetrated in a house of God. How do we turn grief, anger, and despair into purpose and action? Those of us who are Christians are challenged by Jesus Christ to forgive 70 times 7, a daunting, even impossible task for most of us. But then we have seen that scriptural admonition in action. Isn't it amazing, remarkable even, when fear, doubt, desire for revenge might have been expected, but instead forgiveness is found. Although a fundamental part of our doctrine, its practice is the most difficult thing we are ever called to do. But that's what we saw on Friday, when one by one, grieving parents, siblings, and other family members looked at that young man who had taken so much from them and said, I forgive you. Wanda Simmons, the granddaughter of Reverend Daniel Simmons, said, although my grandfather and the other victims died at the hands of hate, this is proof. Everyone's plea for your soul, she said to the killer, is proof that they lived in love, so hate won't win. Their act of mercy was as stunning as his act of cruelty. Hate cannot win. There is no future without forgiveness, Archbishop Desmond Tutu taught us, and forgiveness is the first step toward victory in any journey. I know it's tempting to dismiss a tragedy like this as an isolated incident, to believe that in today's America, bigotry is largely behind us, that institutionalized racism no longer exists. But despite our best efforts and our highest hopes, America's long struggle with race is far from finished. We can't hide from hard truths about race and justice. We have to name them and own them and change them. That's why I appreciate the actions begun yesterday by the governor and other leaders of South Carolina to remove the Confederate battle flag from the State House. Recognizing it as a symbol of our nation's racist past that has no place in our present or our future. It shouldn't fly there. It shouldn't fly anywhere. And I also commend Walmart for deciding to remove any product that uses it. Today, Amazon, eBay, and Sears have followed suit, and I urge all sellers to do the very same. But you know, and I know, that's just the beginning of what we have to do. The truth is, equality, opportunity, civil rights in America are still far from where they need to be. Our schools are still segregated, in fact, more segregated than they were in the 1960s. Nearly 6 million young Americans between the ages of 16 and 24 are out of school and out of work. Think of that, neither learning nor working. And the numbers are particularly high for young people of color. Statistics like these are rebukes to the real progress we have made, and they pose an urgent call for us to act publicly, politically, and personally. We should start by giving all of our children the tools and opportunities to overcome legacies of discrimination, to live up to their own God-given potentials. I just saw some of the young people attending camp here at the church down in the basement, and I was thrilled to see that, because that is the kind of commitment we need more of in every church, in every place, until every child is reached. And I hope we can take that as a cause for action. I learned this not from politics, but from my mother, who taught me that everybody needs a chance and a champion. She knew what it was like to have neither one. Her own parents abandoned her. By 14, she was out on her own working as a housemaid. Years later, when I was old enough to understand, I asked her, "What kept you going?" Her answer was very simple: kindness along the way from someone who believed she mattered. All lives matter. And for her, it was the first grade teacher who saw she had nothing to eat at lunch and, without embarrassing her, brought extra food to share. It was the woman whose house she cleaned who agreed to let her go to high school so long as her work got done. Because those people believed in her, gave her a chance, she believed in me. And she taught me to believe in the potential of every American. That inspired me to go to work for the Children's Defense Fund after law school. It inspired me to work for the Legal Services Corporation, where I defended the rights of poor people to have lawyers. I saw lives changed because an abusive marriage ended or an illegal eviction stopped. In Arkansas, at the law school there, I supervised law students who represented clients in courts and prisons, organized college scholarship funds for single parents, led efforts for better schools and better health care. So I know what personal kindness, political commitments, and public programs can do to help those who are trying their best to get ahead. That's why we need to build an economy for tomorrow, not yesterday. You don't have to look far from this sanctuary to see why that need is so urgent. But you also don't have to look far to see that talent and potential is all right here, if only we unleash it. I believe that talent is universal, but opportunity is not. We need to rebuild the American Opportunity Society for the 21st century. And you might ask, how do we do that? Well, first start looking at the faces and the energy of the young people I just saw downstairs. We have to start early. Make sure every four-year-old in America has access to high-quality preschool. Because those early years are when young brains develop, and the right foundation can lead to lifelong success. Now, I'm not saying this just because I'm now a grandmother of the most amazing, brilliant, extraordinary 9-month-old in the history of the world. I'm saying this because, again, I know what the evidence is. I know that 80% of your brain is developed by the age of 3. So we have to do more. And when I say we, I mean churches and houses of worship. I mean businesses. I mean charities. I mean local governments. All of us have to do more to help families be their child's first teachers from 0 to 5. You know, when I was First Lady of Arkansas, I struggled with this issue. We had a lot of kids, poor kids, in the Delta and South Arkansas and up in the mountains. And we were not going to be able to afford at that point, all those years ago, a universal pre-K program. We had to do more, but we were never going to do enough. So I looked for programs that people could run themselves. And I found a program in Israel, a program designed to help the children of immigrants into Israel, particularly from Ethiopia, who came with their parents seeking religious freedom. They were Ethiopian Jews. They had to escape, but many of them had never been to school. And the secret to the program, called the Home Instruction Program for Preschool Youngsters, was to teach the mother to teach her child. We need to do more of that, and I call on all of us to find ways to reach into those families. And then as our kids grow up, they're going to need not only a good education to prepare them, but the skills for tomorrow's jobs. We need tax credits for businesses that invest in apprenticeships, particularly providing opportunities to economically disadvantaged young people. In order to create those new jobs, we have to attract investment into communities too often ignored or written off. Whether you live in Ferguson or West Baltimore, in coal country or Indian country, you should have the same chance as any American anywhere to get ahead and stay ahead. We should reauthorize the New Markets Tax Credit, which has encouraged billions of dollars in private funding for community development and small businesses in low-income, low-investment areas. It should be permanent. A lot of new jobs are going to come from small businesses, and we know that women and people of color face extra hurdles becoming entrepreneurs. It's harder to find the support networks. It's harder to get that loan. So we've got to do more to knock down the barriers so every good idea that anybody has will get a fair hearing and a chance to create a new business, to employ people and raise their incomes. We must do all we can to be sure our communities respect law enforcement and that law enforcement respects the communities they serve. And we need to come together for common sense gun reforms that keep our communities safe. Key to all of this is revitalizing our democracy and finally persuading the 50 million Americans who do not vote that by not voting, they make it possible for people who do not agree with them, do not support their aspirations, to call the shots. Earlier this month, I went to Texas Southern University to speak out against systematic efforts to disempower and disenfranchise young people, poor people, people of color, and the elderly. We need early voting in every state and automatic universal voter registration. I think every young American, when they turn 18, should be universally, automatically registered unless they say no. Now, if we restitch the fraying fabric of our communities, we will only do so if all Americans do their part. I grew up in the Methodist Church. My mother taught Sunday school and made sure, part of the reason she taught Sunday school was to keep an eye on my brothers, who were supposed to be in Sunday school, but you never knew. So she was there to make sure that they showed up in their classes. But she also made sure we heard the wisdom of John Wesley, the founder of Methodism, to do all the good you can, by all the means you can, in all the ways you can, in all the places you can, at all the times you can, to all the people you can, as long as ever you can. And that meant more than prayer. It meant we had to step out of the church, roll up our sleeves, and get to work. I was blessed with a wonderful youth minister who took some of us into Chicago to hear Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. speak. Now, I grew up in an all-white, middle-class suburb. I didn't have a black friend, neighbor, or classmate until I went to college. And I am so blessed to have had so many in my life since. But I leapt at the chance to hear Dr. King's words. The sermon that evening was titled, Remaining Awake Through a Revolution. Dr. King challenged us to stay engaged in the cause of justice, not to slumber while the world changed around us. I think that's good advice for all of us today. We should all commit to stay awake and stay active, to do our part in our families, our businesses, unions, houses of worship, schools, and yes, in the voting booth. Never stop working for a stronger, more prosperous, more just, more inclusive America. Government has a big part of the responsibility to promote growth, fairness, and justice. But so do all of us. So in quiet moments in the days ahead, in honest conversations, let's talk about what each of us can and should do. Because ultimately, this is really all about the habits of our hearts, how we treat each other, how we learn to see the humanity in those around us, and how we teach our children to see that humanity too. And we don't have to look far for examples. Those 9 righteous men and women who invited a stranger into their midst to study the Bible with them, someone who did not look like them, someone they had never seen before. Their example and their memory show us the way. Their families, their church does as well. So let us be resolved to make sure they did not die in vain. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. Thank you, and God bless you.
Now, how many times did you throw up listening to that speech? I lost count because, you know, it's you wonder whether, actually, let me put it this way. This is a good example of a white supremacist system. We have a total unreality existing on both sides. Here's Hillary Clinton with a long and documented history of lying. She is an inveterate liar. And, in fact, a very conscious beneficiary of a white supremacist system. She's there as a presidential candidate for the second time, telling people about opportunities and so forth, as if she has ever had to struggle in life for opportunities. And you listen to all the things that she thought would matter to an audience of African Americans. You have poverty, she talked about single parenthood, abusive marriages, and all these kinds of things, as if, well, she's recognizing their condition. She's speaking to the problems that they have that need to be solved. Hunger and low unemployment and, you know, the single parent families and all of these kinds of things. We will deal with this in greater detail, but I wanted you to listen to what happens. What is going on here is a complete unreality. The people applauding are literally applauding their own subjugation, and they are vigorous about it. Yes, Hillary, we're with you. And what is her message? On the backs of 9 people, 9 African Americans blown away by a white supremacist, vote. Voting. And you have to fix the society. It's your responsibility. fix this society, and we're all in this together. I don't think so. We will tackle Sister Hillary, continue tomorrow, because there are very important points to be made. But I thank you for joining me today and allowing me to share these thoughts with you. Stay tuned. Coming up next is the NDC Savings Club. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com and let me know what your reactions were to this incredible speech by the Reverend Hillary Rodham Clinton today. I look forward to hearing from you, and it is, as always, a pleasure and a great, great privilege always to be in your esteemed company. See you tomorrow. Bye-bye.